The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The state of Massachusetts is considering whether to authorize the establishment of safe consumption sites. We're going to hear about that on today's show. But first, loyal listeners will recall that I got my start as a drug policy reformer back in 1983 when I started up a chapter of Normal at the University of Iowa. Also went to D.C. for the first time to attend my first Normal conference that year. Now, there was already a Normal chapter at one of the other state schools, Iowa State University. In fact, they were the ones who hooked up the ride from Iowa to D.C. for us. Now, I mention all that because my guest on today's show is Josh Montgomery with the Normal chapter at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Josh, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, first, Matt, tell me about yourself and about the chapter.
Sure. Well, like you said, my name is Josh Montgomery. I'm a senior in electrical engineering at Iowa State University. I actually got my cannabis reform legs under me in 2012 when I helped refound the Iowa State University chapter. And first, let me say that it's so exciting to be talking to a generational activist from 30 years before my time. And it's wonderful to see that activism like this is still going strong in the state of Iowa. But our chapter is seeing a renaissance of sorts on campus. We have about 250 members. It places us right around the third largest student organization on campus. But it's not just numbers. We've got some incredibly talented, professional, charismatic, well-spoken members, and we put on entertaining meetings. We recently hosted Iowa's preeminent medical marijuana dispensary and cultivator, MedFarm, at an event, and we had a wonderful turnout of about 150 students.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, so I want to ask. I'll ask you some more about your chapter in a minute, but. Well, one of the reasons I got in touch with you, the Des Moines Register, of course, is Iowa's largest newspaper. On Sunday, September 26th, the editorial board called for the legalization of marijuana. It's the first time they've ever done so. They wrote in that editorial, quote, Iowa should swiftly permit wider medicinal and recreational use with reasonable restrictions such as barring purchase and use by minors, end quote. They also wrote, quote, Iowans and their local and state elected officials should pressure Congress to relax federal law on marijuana. But just as other states have shown, there's plenty Iowa can do on its own to make marijuana laws fairer, to make marijuana laws fairer and more sensible, end quote. So I'd imagine you were kind of psyched when you saw they'd published that.
Psyched is a good way to put it. Couldn't have been more proud of the preeminent news source in the state of Iowa. The Des Moines Register demonstrated once again why they're the voice of the people in the state of Iowa and why they have been for a very long time. I think it was timely. I think they waited an appropriate amount of time until public opinion had shifted sufficiently to the majority in Iowa. And now they speak for the people.
So you definitely think that this reflects the general attitude of Iowans these days?
Oh, it absolutely does. I think it's not necessarily a vehement opposition to legalization that has kept us from making progress on this point, but rather a general apathy. And I think the Des Moines Register realizes now that it's time to act, and it's time to stop sitting back and watching other states pass us by.
As I said, I haven't lived in Iowa since the 1980s. There has definitely been a shift in attitudes over that amount of time. What's it like? I got to know, what's it like organizing for legalization on campus these days?
It's a great question. It's a ton of fun because so many students come to Iowa State University, and it's a community of 36,000 students, and they, in some cases, struggle to find their place. They kind of know what they want to do with their career. They kind of know the people that they want to hang out with, but when they see Normal ISU, they think, oh my goodness, this is something that resonates with me, that I can connect with, where I will feel welcome to be myself, and where I can really make a difference in helping the people of Iowa avoid the tragedies of prohibition, like, for instance, the outrageous incarceration rate in our state, or the lack of access to necessary medicine. So it's a beautiful blend of culture and activism, and it gives an outlet for people in the state of Iowa that not just on Iowa State's campus, but in the state of Iowa that is woefully lacking.
Now, you're doing a sign-on letter in support of legalization, right? Tell me about that.
Oh, we sure are. So we in early summer, some of the leaders of the organization circulated a draft letter that we wrote collectively that we would hope would speak for the opinions of the majority of Iowans and wouldn't be too polarizing. So we tried not to take extremely strong stances on any one particular argument because there are so many good arguments. And what we are doing is we are trying to provide a platform for Iowans to show their support for this cause that otherwise didn't exist. Iowa has a fascinating political structure where they do not have a ballot referendum process. So we can't just collect petition signatures, throw this on the ballot, despite what the legislators say, and get it pushed through into law. We have to get on our hands and knees and beg our elected officials to do it for us. And a letter like this allows us to show them that thousands of people that vote for them expect them to act on this cause. And our URL to sign our letter is legalizeiowaletter2021.com. So far, we have 5,000 signatures. Our goal is 10,000. We are going to use the counties that people list while signing our letter to map them to their representative, their respective representatives. So we can map constituents directly to the representatives, and the representatives recognize, oh my goodness, the people that vote for me care about this. And if I don't get behind this, they're going to vote for somebody else.
Speaking with Josh Montgomery, he's the outreach coordinator and treasurer at Normal ISU. That's Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. So now when I was prepping for our chat, remember this news story from almost a decade ago about Iowa State's Normal chapter? And that was you. So Josh, talk to me about the T-shirts.
Oh, the T-shirts are one of the greatest Normal ISU legacies. I would have loved to see an incarnation of the chapter back in the 70s when it got started, but in the 2012 to 2018 range, we made a T-shirt that we really, frankly, when we restarted the chapter, we were throwing anything at the wall to get it to stick in the state of Iowa, because Colorado had just legalized, Washington had just legalized, and there was a buzz about this cause that had not previously existed in the state of Iowa, perhaps since early Prohibition days in the 1930s. So we were doing everything that we could. We were trying to host events. We were trying to bring guest speakers in. And of course, we wanted apparel to show our support, to normalize support for this cause on campus. We made this shirt. And as it turns out, the way that we made the shirt ended up being pretty controversial. We went through all of the appropriate official channels to put the mascot of Iowa State University next to a pot leaf and leaning on the word ISU. So it said Normal ISU on the front with Cy the Cyclone, the Iowa State University mascot, on the front. And on the back, it said Freedom is Normal at ISU, with a pot leaf above that that statement that couldn't have been more than an inch and a half tall. And that just set the some state representatives into a tizzy. They lost their minds. They called the Iowa State University administrators and said, shut this down. I don't care how it happens. We're going to cut funding to the university. And so the administrators, without thinking twice, rewrote the rules, punished our chapter because we were too successful and too popular, and nobody in the Iowa State University administration wanted to see the pot club be the most popular club on campus when they're more interested in showing off the robotics team or the young professionals or what have you. So we had all of this energy and momentum, and we sold out of the shirts in a matter of 24 hours, and we placed another enormous order for a second batch of shirts, and they immediately put a stop on it. They rewrote the rules. They censored us into oblivion. We couldn't use mascots. We couldn't use the trademark logos anymore, and they really only put that scrutiny on our organization. So after about a six-month period, we thought, This is unworkable. There is no compromise here. We have to seek to rectify this in some way. So we sought out legal counsel. A First Amendment rights organization called FIRE funded a federal lawsuit. And long story short, I highly encourage listeners to look it up, the Normal ISU Freedom of Speech lawsuit. But long story short, we ended up winning an Eighth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals case against Iowa State University after we won at the district court level at the summary judgment stage, and led to $1 million settlement. A vindication of our rights and a statement, a shot heard around the world for all students that seek to advocate for what they believe in.
Just well done. Well done. Well done. I don't suppose you're not selling the t-shirts now, are you?
We only have a few of the historic ones left because since we won the, that's a great question. Since we won the lawsuit, Iowa State University rewrote the rules for everyone, tightening the screws. And so in a sort of dark twist of fate, everybody's ability to advocate for themselves was reduced as a result of that freedom of speech victory. You know, you win some, you lose some. One step forward, two steps back in a way. But we are going to make new t-shirts soon, and they will express our cause, and they will have insignia that we support, but they probably won't have the Iowa State mascot on them because the trademark policies have changed dramatically in light of our lawsuit victory.
Well, legalize, maybe the border regions will rethink.
I'd like to see it. We'd love to see it.
So now give me the website again for your sign-on letter, and does the chapter have a site, and what is it, in social media and anything like that?
Yes, thank you very much for asking. So the URL letter, and we encourage everyone to sign it, Iowa resident or Iowa non-resident, because we are going to compartmentalize those two groups of people before we send them to all of the Iowa state representatives. The URL letter for the letter is legalizeiowaletter2021.com. The campaign is going to end at the end of November. We encourage anybody who is interested in this cause to sign it, but particularly Iowa residents. And Normal ISU does have a social media outlet. I think the one that we use most frequently is our Facebook page. You can find us at facebook.com/normalisu. That's NORMLISU. Sort of an atypical phonetic spelling, but anybody that knows normal knows it. So that again is facebook.com/normalisu. Please reach out if you have any interest in helping us fight this fight in Iowa.
Brilliant. Again, folks, has been speaking with Josh Montgomery, the outreach coordinator at Normal ISU. That's Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. The one register on September 26th editorialized calling for the legalization of marijuana, the first time that venerable newspaper has done so. Josh, thank you so much, and the best of luck.
Absolutely. Legalize it, guys. Thank you for your time.
That was my interview with Josh Montgomery. He's the outreach coordinator for Normal ISU, the Iowa State University chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The state of Massachusetts is considering whether to allow the establishment of safe consumption sites in that state. The legislature's Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use and Recovery held a hearing on the subject September 27th. Let's hear from a few of the witnesses. Here's Liz Wynott, Director of Harm Reduction Programs at Tapestry Health Systems.
My name is Liz Wynott. I'm the Director of Harm Reduction of Tapestry in Western Mass. Tapestry operates multiple syringe service programs in Franklin, Hampshire, and Hampden County. And it's been a joy to listen in today. I've been listening for a few hours and have just been pretty moved by a lot of the testimony. Listening especially to Representative Dome and Sabados' testimony, it made me want to just talk a little bit about the history, like my history at Tapestry and what I've been able to kind of be a part of. So I started at Tapestry in 2008. And at that time, I started at the Northampton Syringe Service Program, and that was the only above program west of Boston that was in operation. At that time, there were only four. In 2012, I was able to witness the opening of the fifth in the entire state, which happened in Holyoke. And it happened because of the tremendous leadership of Mayor Alex Morris at that time and also of the Board of Health. So they went and approved a syringe service program to open. And the city of Holyoke has been heavily hit by heroin and other drugs for years before, longer than I've been alive. And the leadership at that time, was really saw the need for a syringe service program. And that resulted in some political backlash. And it resulted in a actual lawsuit that happened to try to shut the program down at that time. And for the next 4 years after that, it was really actually interesting to kind of see the not only the backlash, but the increase in support for syringe services as people continue to hear the overwhelming amount of evidence associated with them. So that lawsuit actually, I think, led to a change in the language related to how approval happens. It led to an increase in syringe services. So Holyoke was number 5 in 2012, and now there's well over 30. And I personally have been lucky enough to be part of the political approval process in 10 different towns in Western Massachusetts. And actually just this year, Tapestry is now gearing up to open up or to expand our syringe service programs in the town cities of Westfield, Montague, Amherst, and Belchertown. And I just wanted to quickly say that because I think the history of the expansion is very reflective of the increased support of harm reduction and really increased understanding of how effective these programs are, and how effective providing, you know, things like providing people with tools like Narcan and unused syringes are in saving lives. And I see self-safe conceptions as a natural extension of these services and something that's long overdue. So one of the things that I've heard today and one of the things I am really tired of hearing about is people coming into our programs and us providing them education around safer use and Narcan and then leaving them there, our site, and having no choice but to use in a public restroom or in a bedroom or somewhere alone and then dying. I know I can count multiple like examples of lives that I know would have been saved if we had been allowed to let people use in our sites, you know, again, under supervised care so that somebody could have been available to reverse an overdose when no one else is allowed to.
That was Liz Wynot, Director of Harm Reduction Programs at Tapestry Health Systems. Now, here's Mary Wheeler, Program Director of Health Innovations Healthy Streets Outreach Program.
My name is Mary Wheeler. I've been providing harm reduction services such as syringe access and naloxone distribution and unconditional love to people who use drugs in Massachusetts since 1999. I sit here 22 years later asking yet again that the lives of people take precedent over politics, stigma, and fear, that we allow science to lead us to a place where we can protect human life, provide dignity and safety to human beings. I often think, why do we so often, when it comes to substance use, push aside solutions that could save human lives, reduce medical costs and strain on emergency medical responders? Why do we feel as though it is okay to prolong the decision-making process in regard to the lives of people who use substances? It is unethical and dangerous to withhold information, services, and solutions based on feelings people have about drugs. It is embarrassing as a nation on this planet that we refuse to adopt evidence-based practice to save people that use drugs as other countries have. We are, however, willing to invest time and funds into the prison system, the DEA, the war on drugs, ineffective and forced coercive treatment programs, hurting people, not saving lives, destroying families, and telling thousands of individuals that use substances that we do not care if you die. We are unwilling to put into place possible solutions so you don't die in the street because we don't like what you do. When I hear people tell me harm reduction doesn't work, I respond with, well, how do you really know? No one has given us a fighting chance to fully implement harm reduction as it should be implemented. What has been done for decades has not worked and has caused irreparable damage. Here, us as harm reduction folks, this is how we live. When they call and they don't text, our first ask is, who is dead? When we wake up, we check Facebook, which to us is just a rolling obituary. When we go to work, we want to do so much, but have to work within a broken system that is not evolving fast enough to truly and safely support people we love. When we can't find somebody, we check legacy.com or open up our jail app to see if they are dead or in prison. We stand outside public bathrooms, Narcan in hand, heart racing, being ready because we have to be. We are so tired of waiting for people in places of power to make decisions that will save our people's lives. I ask that you let the state and country know that Massachusetts, not just Boston, there's a lot of us out there, is a place that is no longer going to support the tragic death of people based on what they put into their bodies and the stigma associated with it. Safe consumption sites and drug decriminalization is a vital jumping off point to changing a system that has failed so many. And just to mirror what Representative Sabadosa stated, you know, we are the watchers, harm reduction specialists. We're the watchers. We're tired. We're unsupported. Thank you.
That was Mary Wheeler, Program Director of Health Innovations Healthy Streets Outreach Program. Here's Rachel Bolton, a program and outreach organizer with the Material Aid and Advocacy Program.
My name is Rachel Bolton, and I live in Somerville, Massachusetts. I'm an outreach worker who works alongside people who are unhoused and use drugs. I'm writing to strongly urge you to give a favorable report to bills S1272 and H2088 and move the bills out of the committee. I support SCS because I know that overdose deaths are preventable. With a safer and supportive environment, people's overdoses will be quickly reversed. Supervised consumption sites not only reduce fatal overdose and the spread of infectious disease, but also alleviates the harms of policies that target people who use drugs and survive in public. People who use drugs also risk losing shelter and housing and risk arrest or involuntary commitment. The evidence shows that SCS create a safer environment that reduces the risks associated with drug use because they provide new syringes and provide a place to dispose of used syringes and have people who can respond with naloxone and oxygen in the case of an overdose. SCS also make people more likely to seek treatment for disease and substance use disorder. I have witnessed the punitive and fatal outcomes when people use alone, whether out of stigma, fear, or survival. A friend recently housed in a recovery died of an overdose alone in his apartment. Had there been a place where he could go to use with a community who would welcome him, encourage him to do a test shot to evaluate his tolerance after a period of abstinence, he may not have experienced an overdose, let alone a fatal one. On outreach, I found a person alone in a hidden area under a bridge who had overdosed and was stiff and cold by the time I arrived and began responding. I have also responded to overdoses that rely on a creative and piecemeal approach. These overdoses have occurred within a mile radius of the needle exchange, in locked porta potties, in abandoned churches, and in parking garages. These are places where people who use drugs create community safety responses, avoid police harassment, and set up places to live and survive. These somewhat chaotic overdose responses involve blowing whistles, running through traffic, and breaking down doors. Had a supervised consumption site existed, people would have had access to a supportive place to use drugs, and there would have been a coordinated, dignified, and effective response to overdose. As I wrote this testimony, my friend and old co-worker called to share that three community members, dearly beloved people, died of overdose over the weekend that I was writing this. Before that, for 6 weeks straight, I have received news of people who have died from overdose, many who are younger than 24 and living on the street. The evidence shows that we lose 5 community members a day to overdose in Massachusetts. These are people who are saving each other's lives, who have to create makeshift systems to keep themselves and each other safe, and people who are telling us that supervised consumption sites would save the lives of loved ones. And we know that. The evidence shows it. SCS save lives from many angles, including reducing infectious disease like HIV and Hep C, and reducing injection-related injury by providing new syringes and equipment. We need to be responsive. Thank you.
That was Rachel Bolton, a program and outreach organizer with the Material Aid and Advocacy Program. Now here's Cassie Hurd, Executive Director of the Material Aid and Advocacy Program.
My name is Cassie Hurd. I'm the Executive Director of the Material Aid and Advocacy Program here in Cambridge. We work in Cambridge with Boston in people who use drugs and people who are unhoused. I'm testifying on behalf of our leadership and the organizing group, who are also active members of CIFMA now. I work with Rachel and TJ, who is also waiting to speak. We are reaching out to urge the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use, and Recovery to give a favorable report for an act relative to harm reduction and racial justice, and an act relative to preventing overdose death and increasing treatment access. We ask you to move the bills out of committee as quickly as possible. As Rachel said, the health and lives of many of our beloved community members depend on it. MAP supports and empowers community members experiencing homelessness and living in poverty through material aid, access to resources, and organizing. Housing justice, racial justice, ending the war on drugs, prison abolition, decriminalization of homelessness, accessible and comprehensive health care are all of our work. People who use drugs, especially those who are unhoused and unsheltered, need both less police and less policing. Community members consistently report to us being over-policed, having their belongings taken and destroyed by police, being moved along by police, and being criminalized for being poor and having a substance use disorder or simply using or having substances. When we say policing, we mean other forms of social control, such as forced mental health and substance use disorder treatment, which some of our core organizers and disproportionate number of unhoused people experience, that is not effective and deadly. We know that forced commitment of a person who uses substances puts them at twice the risk of experiencing a fatal overdose than those who voluntarily choose to enter treatment on their own. The $1.8 million in funding that the state is planning to allocate to the South Bay House of Corrections that Sheriff Tompkins is seemingly seeking to use to increase beds for involuntary treatment is inhumane, ineffective, and as we've already said, deadly. This similar loan, four people have died there while in holding. Our community has echoed that forced treatment has not reduced their use of substances and has been abusive, traumatizing, destabilizing, and coercive. People need access to increased harm reduction services and voluntary treatment as part of a comprehensive public health response to meet their self-identified needs, not further criminalization that has failed us and continues to most disproportionately target and impact Black and Brown community members and communities as the war on drugs has for the last 50 years. Many others have shared the abundance of evidence that supports supervised consumption sites. I will reiterate that there have been zero deaths at any supervised consumption site over the past 30 years. SCS are proven to save lives and improve the health and well-being of people who use drugs. People can access treatment for HIV infections, medication for opioid use disorder, and voluntary enterally detox. In addition to being provided sterile supplies, overdose reversal, and wound care. These services are accompanied by the cultivation of trusting relationships with peers and providers that created a healthier community for us all. MAPS leadership, board, and organizers in advocating for evidence-based solutions to this crisis. As members of CIFMA Now, we have fought to authorize SCS in Massachusetts since 2016, advocating for and helping to develop the legislation that would authorize SCS engaging in community education and holding rallies, die-ins at the State House. We are members of Somerville's SCS.
Fantastic. Appreciate your testimony. If you could wrap it up, please. Thank you.
We in our community are doing what is in our power to support people and save lives. Yet due to the lack of political will, this year alone we've lost over 100 community members. This summer we lost one person a week, some weeks two or three. Each person was a pivotal member of our community who cared for friends, family, and strangers. The responsibility to save lives should not continue to fall on people who use drugs, who are balancing so many crucial needs and commitments. We need the political will to authorize SCS and decriminalize drugs. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Cassie Hurd, Executive Director of the Material Aid and Advocacy Program. They testified before the Massachusetts Legislature's Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use, and Recovery at a hearing on September 27th to discuss decriminalization of possession of drugs and the establishment of safe consumption sites. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is produced for the Drug Truth Network and distributed by the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. Please support your local community and public radio stations. Become a member today. You can find this edition of Century of Lies along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.